All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're going to get into some Illuminati stuff with the Kubrick film Eyes Wide Shut. And you can find the show notes more for this one at actualanarchy.com/230. That's 230. And before we introduce our guest for this Christmas movie that we're recording at the end of April, let's say hello to my co-host, Robert. How are you doing there? And you look like you got a little bit of sun.
Yeah, I got even more sun, everybody. I know everybody's super excited to know this, but yeah, I'm bronzing real up. I got all kinds of new freckles that have joined me on my life adventure. And yeah, I'm really excited to see them. I haven't named them because there are infinite. But yeah, I'm really happy about it. Spending a little time outdoors, jumping on my trashed trampoline. I've been riding horses. Well, horse, singular, but multiple rides, both of them successful to varying degrees. I haven't fallen off, but I did get my balls kind of crushed. So it's, you know, you get some good, some bad, but it's a learning process. And yeah, I highly recommend it for all you people that, you know, enjoy riding. Keep doing it. For those of you who don't enjoy riding, stay the hell off those horses, man.
Yeah, those farm animals, they can be dangerous. I got attacked by our rooster today because I was in there collecting an egg and a ball that I'd thrown in. Well, I was throwing the ball for the dog, and it hit a tree, and it went into the coop area, and then the cock came after me pretty hard. So dangerous farm animals.
That cock came after you really hard, huh? That hard cock. That's interesting. Did you get pecked? Was there any pecking involved from this cock?
Yeah, the cockerel came up behind me and assumed a superior position, made me his bitch, I think, like if we were in a prison yard. And yeah, he pecked at me, and then I gently nudged him with my foot to get him away from me. So he learned his lesson. He figured out I was the bigger man, and he's backed off at this point. But I'm glad that he was doing his job. That's the important thing.
It sounds like a property rights issue. You were invading his property that he has homesteaded with his hens, and you were an invader. Is this correct?
Well, if we want to get down into the weeds, technically, he's on my property that I have permitted use for him, and he is my property. I own him.
And does he understand your Misesian property rights philosophy, being a chicken? Does he?
No, but he's lucky I didn't eat him. So okay, I'll just leave it at that. Fair enough. Anyway, I know this is riveting conversation, and it's only going to get better as we start talking about a Kubrick film. So let's get into that right after these messages from the Last Nighters. Who are us? Hey everyone, it's Daniel.
Oh my.
Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. And we're going to
make it stop.
We're going to do My Little Pony episode tonight. Now we're doing Eyes Wide Shut, the Stanley Kubrick classic that features a lot of masks and a lot of deranged activity. Kubrick, of course, famously did The Shining, that also had some weird furry action in it. And so we're going to be doing one that has a little bit more intense kind of weird stuff going on, and that is Eyes Wide Shut. And we're going to be having our guest, Mike C., who has come on many times, many, many times, most recently for, well, it wasn't most recently, but you were on for a couple of Christmas episodes. The most recent of those was Kingdom of Heaven, and you've been on for RoboCop and a bunch of other good stuff. So welcome back to the show, Mike. I appreciate all the memes we've been sharing and the music you've been sharing with me and the time you spent with us on the show. Oh, and by the way, show notes more, lastnighters.com/173. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
I was muted. Hi, I'm Mike. I don't eat chicken, but I do eat fish, which has the vitamin D that's helpful to fight against respiratory infections. Anyway, yeah, I've been on the show a few times. I like Christmas movies, apparently. Yeah, that's about it.
All right, very good. And you've been doing more music at Mechanical Dream Revolution, as found on SoundCloud, and you just released a new track recently, so we'll put that on the show notes page.
Yeah, it's four tracks of just basically workout music. You know, it's kind of a little more. I liberated myself from a four-year project or five-year project that went on, and really broke my back. And now I'm just doing kind of fun stuff for a bit. So check it out. It's 4 hours of straight fire if you need some inspiration to get your lifting on.
Okay. Well, that's also a good thing to, you know, focus on health, sunlight, getting exercise,
yeah,
social
crazy.
Interactions.
It's crazy that no government on earth used this as an opportunity to talk about health or good health or healthy lifestyles. It's very strange behavior from people that would have our best interest in mind.
I don't think you're wrong there. And perhaps some of the reasoning might be found in some of the meaning behind this movie with all the symbolism and other things going on. Now, I know Robert is going to have a lot of naysaying to do on this one, so I'm looking forward to that, Robert.
More like
always naysaying. He doesn't create, but you know, I'm a big fan of Kubrick, and I consider him a master filmmaker, and he fills every scene purposefully, and there's all sorts of intention and meaning that he puts into it, but it also has a little bit of ambiguity, so that there's a subjective artistic experience for the viewer as well, which I think lends itself to a lot of fan theory and a lot of ideas of what he intended with certain things. So I'm sure, Mike, you're going to give a couple of interesting hot takes on this one.
I had my morning coffee today and just sat down with the movie with pause button in hand and made some serious notes. Where Nolan, like Christopher Nolan, is a master propagandist who has very specific ideas that he wants to give you. And he uses like emotional sort of subterfuge to get them right to your subconscious. So you have like an emotional experience that processes these ideas. Kubrick is more about enlightening the audience and giving you like breadcrumbs to kind of discover the world around you and what's going on. So like with The Shining, there's like, you know, all these different like takes where you can get, you know, the Apollo shit and the American Indian genocide and the child abuse sort of cycle and stuff out of that. I love Kubrick for that because he's like, it's all ambiguous, so you're allowed to just kind of go in as far as you want. Yeah, you're allowed to wander and you're allowed to turn these ideas over, so he's not a propagandist. He's almost an anti-propagandist, a true artist. Definitely the best filmmaker in history, in my opinion.
Did a hell of a job with Moon Landing.
Yeah.
Damn it, you're stealing my thunder, Daniel. I was going to say, is this a better movie than The Moon Landing? I don't know which one's better.
Yeah, because like...
The Moon Landing had better acting, but Eyes Wide Shut has better special effects.
Like, he's supposed to be the color commentator, and you're the straight man, right? So stay in your lane.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll stop trying to make jokes. I do the dad jokes, and they're usually not very funny, except to me and maybe my kids occasionally. But how we usually start this off is the old Google description. So I'm going to add this on screen. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so Eyes Wide Shut, 1999, rated R, mystery / drama film, 2 hours and 45 minutes. So, Mike, as I'm sure you've mentioned in the pre-show bonus content available for our Patreon supporters, lastnerd.com/Patreon, there is at least 20 minutes missing, right? So this would have been a three-hour film. So this got a 7.4 on IMDb, 75% Rotten Tomatoes, 68% Metacritic, and 83% of Google users liked it. The description reads, after Dr. Bill Harford's wife, Alice, admits to having sexual fantasies about a man she met, Bill becomes obsessed with having a sexual encounter. He discovers an underground sexual group and attends one of their meetings and quickly discovers that he is in over his head. That's quite the description. July 16, 1999 was the release date. Kubrick, of course, is the director, has a lot of classical type music in it, and stars Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman and Sidney Pollack. And then also the guy Todd Field, who plays Nick Nightingale. Apparently, he became quite the director himself, doing a movie called In the Bedroom, which I have not seen, but have read is very, very good. Robert, let's go to you for your opening take.
Okay, so Eyes Wide Shut, a movie I had never seen before prior to this viewing.
I was expecting more. I was expecting some really racy stuff. Instead, what I got was a pretty coherent fish out of water slash mystery movie about a doctor that has a wild night. It plays out fairly interestingly. I mean, we're given kind of these breadcrumbs of what might be happening. And then ultimately, it's just him hanging out with a bunch of people that like to have this weirdo kinky sex. I know Mike's going to have all kinds of interesting weird takes on this, saying that it's about more, that there's all this meaning and symbolism and this and that. I didn't see any of that. Now, obviously, it's my first viewing. Maybe Mike's going to point out some genius thing, and then I'm going to have to go back and look at it and go, oh, my goodness, I can't believe how blind I am, because Mike is just going to illuminating knowledge on me.
There's like 200 hours of like YouTube analysis and people just waxing about all manner of shit. I
recently watched a video about a guy talking about how Jaws is essentially an allegory for capitalism. And that was just purely an indictment against capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And that sounds like something Spielberg would put in his like greatest like blockbusters is his beginning of becoming a great
Spielberg
director.
Spielberg made that movie when he was
everyone.
Like 23 years old or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd
he
sell out at 23 if I could. If I could go
made.
Back and sell it at 23. Certainly, if I was like part of some group of people that all took care of each other and told each other what messages to stay on board with, like I would definitely not step out of line if, well, I mean, I would, but you know, a lot of people wouldn't. I'd like
I
to think that I would.
It's a whole lot of people giving other people way too much credit. I can't imagine you can project onto people your own ideas of what something is about. But
yeah,
as
it's called art.
I understand that, Michael.
All right.
But to say that the 23-year-old Spielberg was really creating this blockbuster as an indictment against capitalism.
Well, I know a psychologist might say that he manifested it at some subconscious level because it does, like, you know, when somebody points it out, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of a critique of capitalism. It's like, you know, it's the unknown and we're dumb and we like open up the beach, even though, you know, global warming is right there. We got to go back to the Paris Accords. You know, I don't know. I could see somebody putting those together. Even if it's not accurate in the eyes of Spielberg, you know, you can kind of transpose those over each other and you get a lot of like sync ups.
Yeah, you know,
like
now, Robert,
Pink Floyd and Dark Side of Oz.
Yeah.
It just kind of works. I don't think that they had that in mind, but it kind of works. It's funny to stone and watch.
Now, of course, Jaws was in the late 70s, right? So I don't know if a lot of those things
were... Yeah, that was the zeitgeist, right? Really anti-capitalist. A lot of science fiction, fantasy themes that were very like, oh, we're all fucked. We're going to get overpopulated. And we don't do something now. We don't do something about this monster.
Yeah. Well, Robert, what was the point you wanted to make about watching that that take regarding Jaws? Because that was one that our past guest, Pete Quinones, suggested that we check out.
Oh, it's very interesting, and I look forward to talking about that. I was just saying how there's a lot of thought that goes into dissecting every Kubrick movie, and I'm sure they work on multiple levels for multiple people, but there's a whole lot of projection of armchair psychologists and historians and philosophy buffs who project all kinds of ideas onto these films where the artist had no intention of creating them. And like Mike's saying, maybe it's this deep-seated psychology that's he's just making out of art because it's all subliminal and whatever. Subconscious. I just...
Cool.
Okay, whatever. Anyway, let's just talk about this movie.
You were told it was going to be an erotic journey or whatever, and so is the studio, and then they got this fucking Illuminati fucking roadmap.
Did it, though? Really?
And then Kubrick died, so whatever. It's all good. Ziegler, right? Ziegler's in the movie, right? He's the...
Sidney Pollack.
Yeah. So, I love Sidney Pollack, by the way. So, Ziegler means, like, bricklayer. It's a weird coincidence, right? Like just to start you off, and you get these coincidences piling on top of each other, like over and over, and you start going like, "Okay, well, maybe I should look for patterns." What's that called when you see patterns that aren't there? There's a word for it. I don't have the word in my mind anymore, but anyway, so they got the brilliance of this is that it's got a lot of layers to it. Like there's very superficial layers, and you can work all the way down to as far into this sort of New World Order, or not New World Order, but like the whole like Illuminati shit that you want to get to. And I'm saying that kind of tongue in cheek, just because it's a way easier placeholder to use that than some elongated explanation every single time. I'm just gonna say Illuminati. It's just way easier, you know. Like, Bill Burr mentioned this. Like, he's like, "Oh, all those fucking Illuminati sex parties or whatever," in one of his stand-ups. So it's hit the zeitgeist, which is good, which is what he was intending. I don't know. I think the easiest thing to do is just get into the layers of it, to be honest, and like what I saw in it. Because like, I don't know. There's just a lot of coincidences that are hard to write off.
Well, let's start with the basics. Like, what's the kernel of the idea that Kubrick saw in the novel or novella that was the inspiration that made him want to do this for decades?
Okay, so I think I wrote down like four layers, basically, where you get like masks at the first layer, which is like our ego and relationships, which is essentially what the novel's about. And then you get one layer sort of deep and you sort of get into the institutions of power that affect our relationships on top of that. And then you start looking at the symbolism and you get kind of an alchemist journey out of that, which is the like enlightenment, essentially, like through the harnessing of knowledge, which is what really gets like, this is what gets confusing with the whole like Illuminati thing, right? It's like Christians tend to really have their back up against like about paganism and any kind of occult symbolism and things like that. But it's not really fair to say that like paganism is directly connected to Satanism. Like that's not a through line at all. Like it's like saying that an atheist worships God essentially, or the wrong God. You know what I mean? Like it's like a completely different thing. It's the religion we have now at, you know, whatever monotheisms we have now are stacked on top of the old systems. And then there was also a competing sort of through line of, you know, people trying to dominate and control each other with knowledge. If that makes sense. So
okay, so are you sort of talking about like there's different classes of people based on their social status in this movie, and Harford is like trying to elite, but then there are these secretive elite who have their own secret special customs and a greater knowledge than, you know, your average Joe who's even, you know, pretty well off, like Bill is. He's a doctor living in Manhattan. They have a very nice place, but he has to work every day.
Yeah. Well, he's being initiated, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's encountering a deeper knowledge of human society and how things actually work. And he's kind of given a choice to take one or the other. And in this movie, like we watched that happen, right? Where he, the first half of the movie, he has a more innocent view of things, of his daughter, of the girl at the costume store, and all these things, right? Like of Domino, for that matter. His wife, yes, exactly. Yeah. And this is the part that I think is missing at the end. There's probably a confession on her part, and we might have got into some like MK Ultra or like child sex cults or some shit like that without, you know, like right into it, because essentially. On one side, you have Bill, who's completely innocent and what's it called? Just has no idea what's going on. And then by the end, naivety, right? So, like, let's take the costume store, right? So the guy is pimping out his daughter. In the first version of that, it looks like it's a mistake that's happening, and the dad's very angry about it. Then when he comes back after he's been initiated and he's come in contact with his knowledge, he finds out that the dad is just basically a pimp, right? And he offers her his daughter to Bill. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, in a literal sense is him being upset at the scene initially, Milich being upset at the scene initially.
It's a facade.
It's for show. It's because Bill's there and he's not initiated.
Yes. That's the surface world that we live in, right? That's the masks that we wear, right? And then we know that these institutions of power affect our lives, but we don't realize how deep the roots go into our psychology and our, you know, our lives, like banks in finance. I mean, that's a huge one, right? With libertarianism, centralized banking. But even if you look at like Okay, what did I write down here? Institutions that protect us versus institutions that like exploit us, essentially, right? So you have like, because I'm married is something you can say to somebody and say, like, I'm in a contract right now. This protects me from losing myself to a sea of debauchery, right? That's like one institution. It's a contract. So that's like, it can hold you back, but it, you know, it's less corrupt than, say, our financial institutions, our media, you know, and our... yeah, media, marriage, money, right? And then we have, like, on the other side, you have the commodification of the human sexual experience now with, like, Tinder and Bumble and Hinge and all that shit, right? Like, if you look at the, if you analyze the way those things interact with people, they're horrific and fraudulent, right?
Yeah, now, I'm having all these, like, different thoughts going on at the same time here, but
yeah, that's kind of the point of the movie, right? So, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm like, it's really hard to kind of focus one's thoughts on this, I guess. So if I ramble, I apologize, I suppose. Although you're not supposed to apologize.
Yeah, never blood apologize.
Blood in the water.
what is the meaning in your view of the opening scene? We're at this party and they've been there before. And
well, the Alex opening
says,
scene,
I don't know why we're always going to these things. We don't know anybody here, but that's sort of like the initiation, right?
Yeah. Cause he's like a good bitch, right?
Right. But then they're both offered temptations, but they both sort of refuse, right? So they're like, you know.
Yep. Well, he doesn't refuse per se. He doesn't, he's not really, oh yeah, I guess he is offered, but he's bailed out.
Yeah, yeah, he's pulled away. And yeah. Do you think that him being pulled away was in order to further initiate him into this circle? Like, do you think that Sidney Pollack's character and Mandy, that situation was concocted to get Bill sort of like on the inside and under some sort of like unspoken, you know, agreement, like beyond the veil?
Oh, yeah, who knows? I mean, I wouldn't say so. I think on the surface, the first half, like, it's kind of a mirror. There's a lot of mirrors in the movie. So I sort of take it as the first half is a bit more innocent. Like, he's just... He probably wouldn't have, like, fucked them either. He probably would have just, like, snapped out of it. Because he seems like a pretty disciplined guy. Until he's, like, emasculated by his wife. He's not really looking for any outside of that. He's just kind of taking in the adoration and the, you know, the flirting and stuff, right? He's like, oh, where are we going, right? And they're like, oh, well. And again, rainbows, right? It's like rainbows occur over and over in this. But where the rainbow ends is what she says to him. And he's like, oh, I'm not really sure about this. I'd like to know more about what you're trying to do to me and how I'm feeling right now before I sign on for that. And that's a very, like, logical sort of masculine brain, although it doesn't always work that way because there's not enough blood to operate both parts of us at the same time.
Both ends, yeah.
Both ends. In over his head, more like in over his heart on, am I right?
All right. So, Robert, do you have any commentary at this point?
I don't even know what you guys are talking about. I just right. started. You guys start talking and I just start daydreaming about other stuff.
Oh, that sucks.
Well, no, it's not. I know that I wish I had more to offer. That's all I'm saying is that it's okay. Hard for me to analyze this film on the level you guys are taking it to.
Okay. So, well, as a libertarian, you're going to have contempt for authoritative institutions of power that limit the freedom of, you know, people and a marketplace, right? So, like, you know, the Knights Templar were kind of the first international banking system, and they were not a very good representation of, like, the Crusades in general. The Vatican had, like, a child... Like, you know, they were masking. I would say that it's probably like on purpose, but they were at least pushing back and obfuscating the pedophilia that was going on in the church, moving priests around and protecting people, right? So these are institutions that should be laudable that are very corrupt by the power within them, and then they affect our lives deeply. And I think that that's part of the movie where they talk about, like, yeah, I guess it doesn't really connect like that, though. Though it just happens to be something I think about institutions. And this movie is about the initiation into those upper levels where they're playing the game beyond the game. Like, we're all trying to fucking make money in the stock market or run a restaurant or invest or whatever. But like, ultimately there's people that will destroy currencies, you know?
Right. Yeah. And speaking of currencies, it seemed like Harvard was, he represented, you know, some affluence, some money, and he was using money to get what he wanted all over the place. And also his title of being a doctor.
And his name.
Like a dozen times. And his name.
Bill.
Right. But when you get into those upper echelons that he encounters, they're no longer dealing with the currency of money. They're dealing in the currency of power.
Yes. Blackmail. Yeah. I'd say like a lot of our political systems and power structures are run on a web of blackmail, right? So like, you know, I started investigating, maybe not a great example for us, but like some drug, you know, getting across the border, like some sort of drug operation, and I investigate it far enough, and then I find out there's human trafficking involved, and then I found out that a senator is involved, and the investigation has to stop. And so what I'm allowed to do as a DEA officer is take down some low-level drug mule or something, you know, and I'm allowed to put my career forward, or I can get myself murdered or put, you know, shipped to Alaska to sit behind a desk or something. But like, I'm not allowed to challenge those with true power running the game beyond what we even see. Right.
Okay.
Is that on topic even? I was trying to provide an example that didn't have anything to do with this movie because Rob hates it.
No, but I could see the parallels, you know, like those who attend that, you know, that secret society party, Sidney Pollack's character even says to Tom Cruise, like, if I told you who those people were, you would be scared, you know, like it would make you worried. And
he was surprisingly courageous or stupid, really, to go to a big, but I guess, I mean, 1999, it's like a, you know, they hadn't seen Eyes Wide Shut because they were in the movie itself. So,
well, what did you guys take of the big fake show? Supposedly, that was all about. Is the movie saying that those people were just there to have a good time and they're not really going to hurt anybody and it's all to protect themselves from exposure?
Yeah, I thought the dramatics were like ridiculous and fanciful to a large extent. Like it seemed like a dream almost from his perspective. Like that whole situation just seemed ridiculous. But maybe that was because we were like getting through the looking glass, and it's like, I think Kubrick wanted to make it seem more fanciful the closer we got to the point which we're like, we're now dealing with the fallout of all that. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure how that relates to Robert's question.
Okay, so my take on that is that it happened, but like our perception as viewers and through the eyes of Bill is that it was very fanciful and ridiculous in a lot of ways. Like the drama of that, the melodrama was preposterous, right? Like it just seemed a bit heightened. Even within the context of what we were watching, it seemed like it had really gone up a notch with the whole, I'll sacrifice myself. But I think the idea with that is that we're still in the innocence and we're still like, we're seeing it melodramatically because it is from the uninitiated position. We're just like getting to this gateway. Makes sense? No, not helping.
Are you guys saying that Bill, the whole is these elite people actually trying to initiate Bill into their society and not he blunders his way into it?
Both simultaneously, because it's like a allegorical. So like, to me, this movie is about Bill encountering these sort of thresholds and not being able to go back. Actually, when he goes down to meet Nick Nightingale in the bar, it's like there's rainbow lights as he sort of descends down a red sort of staircase, right? And then there's a sign that says like, no, or all exits are final or some shit, right? Which is kind of like, these decisions you're going to make now are going to be permanent. So like, you choose God or Satan or whatever other version of that. The material or the spiritual is probably the best way to talk about that if we're talking about occult stuff, right? Because you get the pentagram is sort of the Vitruvian man in the five points, and you have the spiritual realm is dominant, right? So you're enlightening yourself with knowledge to elevate yourself from your base instincts. And then if you invert that, you have the material dominance where we're corrupt beings, sort of controlled by our reptilian brains. And if you look at the way governments work, they tend to be these sort of lizard people type factions or type people that like that use fear and greed and anger, you know, to govern. So how did I get to this?
What was the question? I don't know.
Okay.
Well, now you guys were just talking about the scene where the woman sacrifices herself to save Bill and she has to pay a debt or she has to fulfill this obligation because she knows the rules
and their
of
promises matter.
Right. And what she got herself into. But then later on, when Sidney Pollack is basically explaining it to Tom Cruise, he says, cut the bullshit, gives him some bullshit and then says, cut the bullshit again.
Yeah.
And gives him a different kind of take on it where he says it was all charade. It was all just.
Yeah.
To keep you afraid and whatnot. But I read that as this is just something that like Pollock's character is representing the narrative, the cathedral, saying, here's how you're going to view this, Bill. This is the
running the show.
This is the plausible deniability. This is the seed I'm going to plant in your head to where you aren't quite sure what to believe, but there's enough of this being possible that you can't, you know, you can't feel like you definitely know what happened.
So, yeah, I think that's a pretty good take. I like that.
So it's like it's a power move over Bill. It's
controlling the mind through narrative, right?
Right.
And so they present this really audacious thing you couldn't really describe to a jury. And then he presents another one that's very like very simple and naive, and you can go back to that world if you want, where there's just a bunch of coincidences. She happened to be the person because she recognized him because he saved her in the. That was Maddie, right?
Mandy.
So he saves her in the upstairs or from the overdose or whatever. Well, I don't think he even saves her, but he, you know, talks to her and she recognizes him. And then she bails him out by sacrificing herself. And so he knows all of this is happening. And he's like, okay, well, do I choose like a series of coincidences that are absurd or a melodrama that's absurd? Because these people are so like, what do you say? The oldest and simplest lie is the one that people believe because it's like it's impossible to think people would fall for it forever. The same lie over and over.
Okay. You know,
like we reject the spiritual realm because it feels ridiculous. And we're told to like reject all of these feelings that we have that sort of urge us towards a more natural balance over our base instincts.
Okay. Know? All right. And then early on in the film, it's established that Bill is a very logical thinker. And so
he's very male too, right?
Yeah. So when he's sort of in this dreamscape and seeing all this weird shit, and then Sidney Pollack's character sort of gives him a rational thing to lean on, he knows that he'll grasp at that.
Yeah. Like he's given him an out essentially, right? So this is the choice he has to make at that point.
Okay. Because another way to look at this movie is this is a series of almost something happening, but nothing ever really happening.
No. It's almost like they take a bunch of, they make a bunch of restrictions and then they ebb them back and then they put them forward again and everyone's all like, oh, do we storm the fucking Capitol now? Oh, is today the day? Okay, don't, let's just focus on our business or whatever and try, right? Like, I don't know. It's interesting how you rule people with, I mean, you do with the Iron Fist comes out now and then, like you do pound down people like and hard, but it's more this sort of velvet glove approach of like being very delicate with the minds of your subjects and, fooling them fraud. Right. So I find it interesting that particular group at that party, like their promises matter a lot. Their contracts matter. Our contracts at this level are only as good as the goodwill between the people, right? It's not enforced by any authority. Like, you know, if we do bad business, you have to sue. It's, you know, if you're too poor to fucking make that work, it's not really going to be resolved very well. People cheat on each other all the time, you know? So it's interesting that like this movie says, I think at least it says this, that the people that run your life have contracts that matter a lot. to them and the other person. And there's probably an authority that is, you know, that you can't even conceive of, like making sure that that happens, making sure that that status is maintained, which is, you know, our slow march towards oppression. So these people have their shit together, you know?
It hasn't been so slow lately.
I mean, there's been other tyrannies. There was a Soviet Union. That was pretty rough. China has been going on for a long time. So, I mean, here it's a relatively new idea. Took a good 300 years to sort of chip away at... what's funny is it's not the law, right? Because again, it's just a piece of paper. Like, that doesn't fucking matter. What matters is the spirit of the people, and like whether or not they're like, with especially with this lockdown, it's like, it's not the rat on the face from like 1984 where they're making you afraid. They're giving you the one thing you need, the one thing that you can't live without. They're letting you do that if you behave. So if you need to sport climb, you know, and you need to do it in the gym in Canada because it's cold outside till the middle of summer, you can do that, but you have to wear a mask for doing this pretty exerting exercise, right? Pretty exhausting exercise. But you can do that if you do this one thing. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do it. But a lot of people are going to do that. That makes sense?
If you submit.
If you submit, but it's all compartmentalizing. So it's about taking this the coalescence of community and the coalescence of the male female energies coming together, and it's about separating and commodifying those things so that the machine can just farm you and make you a slave, right? And so if you can just get people to kind of go along because of the one thing that they're selfish about, that's all you got to really do. And then the other side of that is utter fear, right? Because like you'll just be fucking, the cops escalate to killing you, so. You gotta watch out for that when something's, you know, but I don't know. You saw about Ontario, right?
I did. That's
the church.
Yeah. It's a bad situation.
Not the church, no, the police state implementation, right? Is that what you're talking about, Mike?
Yeah, I got full on police state there now, so.
Yeah, they can stop and inquire about your vaccine status at any time, ask you why you're outside at all. Oh, no,
it's like a stay at home order. It's a full on stay at home order.
Why are you outside? Why are you outside of your house? Go back home.
I would say something like, I'm outside for reasons that are not covered by the stay at home order, and you're not allowed to ask me the details about that.
Oh,
a lot of people don't understand.
Right,
huh? Yeah. Well, no, and it's like at that point, you really want to just start shooting people, but you can't because you'll be alone. They've isolated people, so and the communication's difficult to have. So anyway, we should talk about the movie and not how much I want to overthrow my government.
All right. Yeah. In World of Warcraft. Yeah. So let's get back to the movie a little bit. So we have Bill Harford, which apparently in one of the documentaries or something I was reading, he was envisioning a Harrison Ford type character. And that's where the name Harford came from. Harrison Ford.
But then he chose a fucking, what are they called? Scientology power couple.
Yeah.
That's not a mistake, right? That's actually a pretty good move.
It's who were available, I guess, at the time. But, you have Bill who's almost in the midst of this psychological warfare with his wife. Like he trusts her and believes that their relationship is secure. And yet she admits to him in an emasculating way that she has been thinking about other men. And what is it? One of the, you know, 10 commandments is thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. So like just even the thought of something can be in some circles considered almost as much as doing the act itself. So
yeah.
Her thinking about cheating on him with another man is almost as bad to him as her actually doing it. And he's tormented by this.
Yeah. Well, what I like about like commandments and religion, I mean, obviously it's not perfect, but the concept behind it is that it's self-governance in a lot of ways. Like these are guidelines, right? Like the commandments, I mean, yeah, they're rules, but they're rules that are like, if you do these things, you'll stay out of a lot of trouble. So don't covet the neighbor's wife is a very good rule to govern yourself with. And, you know, you self-flagellate if you're sort of Spanish in that era or whatever, but it isn't like, it's not enforced beyond you, which is kind of what I find useful about spirituality and religion, that we form these communities that are sort of outside of government. In fact, like that's what I mean by institutions of or corrupting institutions, right? Is we form these institutions, these structures, and then like sort of God leaves them and we're just left with the structure. And the people that take over that structure are generally fairly corrupt. So we build these monuments of like a republic and then get taken over by the most corrupt people in history. You know what I mean? Because the, anyway.
Yeah, because that's where the corrupt go, or the people that lust for power go.
Yeah. So, our relationships are at one level an egoic exchange or whatever. We have to fight between men and women. We're very different creatures. We have different winning conditions, but we do coalesce to the penultimate sort of creative practice, which is what drives our species forward. So this is like a magic that we need to be aware of. Sexuality is sort of a magical force for men and women to be able to coalesce in ways that like intellect is not gonna work. And that relationship is corrupted heavily by institutions of power that drive us into gender roles that we may or may not like. Gender roles exist at a natural level, but the state or any governing force tends to take laudable or natural qualities or traits and then leverage those and commodify them, if that makes sense. So like patriotism or wanting to defend your family, they get you to enlist and then go fight across the ocean in a war that you don't need to be participating in. When that would be otherwise a laudable quality for a man to want to be strong and brave, and they take that and they use it to make profit and resources, you know. So when it comes to gender roles, it's like the men just become money and the women just become sexual objects within a society that's corrupted. And this movie is in a lot of ways about the grooming process for that. So like in the very first scene, Bill's looking for his wallet and Alice knows where it is. That's the first thing they say to each other.
Right. And then
so where's my money? Oh, I know where your money is. It's by the bedside table. So are you saying?
And then her first line is, how do I look?
Yes. So we establish immediately what the roles for our gender are, and then we examine how those are like both a natural state for men and women, and that's not a bad thing, but how those natural trends or traits are exploited and commodified. And then we actually end up going down sort of a pedophilic grooming ritual with the four stages of like Helena, their daughter, to the girl at the costume store, to Domino, to Alice, who is ultimately grooming Helena in the second half of the movie, where she's talking about a math problem that is literally just, there's two dudes with money, which one has more money? And Bill overhears that from the other room, right? After he's become sort of aware of what's going on around him more. I think there was a through thread of logic with what I just said there. I think I actually held it together that time.
I'll have to rewind the tape and listen to that one, make sure.
Okay. Basically, gender roles exist naturally. They're exacerbated by institutions of power. Those institutions corrupt us and our relationships and exploit us that way by separating us. Men become money and women become sexual objects. And this movie is also about the grooming process of that. But from Bill's perspective, is the journey we're on. We are given the information, and he then crosses the sort of threshold to find out more about like the reality of where he's living.
Visually, all of the women in this are redheads, right? So that's supposed to imply that they're sort of like different stages of the process.
Well, there's also the implication of the redheaded whore of Babylon, right? In the Babylonian, in Revelation. Y'all need Jesus. You don't have to have Jesus in your heart, but you should read fucking the Bible because there's some really good stuff in it. Revelation, Babylon, is basically a one world government state that is collapsing. It's where you get the whole 666 stuff, one world currency. All this stuff that the Christians go like, oh shit, this is happening, right? Like, because it kind of is.
Right. Yeah, I've heard this many times. Yeah. Yes.
So, from Babylon, you get Babylon, spelled Babylon, from the is it Crowley? Aleister Crowley.
The
Book of Law, right, which is the sort of satanic or Luciferian Bible you get in like 1905 or whatever, right? It's coming up from that era, and you get kind of like their version or their take, their perspective on on these ideas, and they're all kind of pro those ideas, and like, hey, these are the good aspects of like going your own way and renouncing God and seeking only the material, you know. So that's another good read too, right? Because it'll give you a perspective on sort of how we got to Rules for Radicals over a 100-year period. Okay, I'm sorry, you're dumbfounded again. Okay, so what did I say? So Babylon, right? It's in the Boney M song sometimes. So you get the Red-Headed Horror of Babylon, and you have the four stages, so they're all the same person. And they are the cycle of corruption for women and how women becoming whores corrupt man's path of enlightenment and make us seek only material instead of spiritual growth and a connection to God. Does that work?
I think so.
You're going to allow it?
I just feel so unequipped to have this conversation right now. I don't know. I watched a movie about a guy that went to some freaky sex night thing. And I mean, obviously there's a whole lot going on in the world.
Okay. What if I made this one weird note. I noticed, I was like, I had this weird thought. I was watching the orgy scene for the third time today. Just kidding. I thought that it was shot pretty tastefully, to be honest. Like, they wanted to portray that there's a bunch of, like, just buck wild fucking going on. But they did like, kind of a slow pan, and they hit as much as they could without detracting from the fact that it's this, like, debauchery. So,
you know what's going on, but it's not. Like,
you have a very good idea what's going on, but they don't show you a lot of, like, there's no penetration on, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I felt like he did as well as he could to convey exactly what he was trying to without making pornography.
For an R rating, I don't know, it all felt really, really tame. Like you're saying, it was very artfully done. It felt like it was just like you're walking into some rando, like I think you see more crazy stuff going on at any random like sex club in the United States than you do at this high-powered.
But you would see it all. You're not being told what to look at by a camera, right? I felt uneasy by the eroticism of it. I think that that's what he was trying to make me feel, is like, this is fucked up and weird. Like, you know what I mean? You should acknowledge that this isn't like possibly arousing, but also realize that like this is some path, and you're on a path, and you should be as conscious as possible while that's happening. Is what sort of what I got out of it. But yeah, I wrote down this though. I wrote down that a strip club is essentially a synthetic version of what we saw in that orgy. Like we see a very similar sort of commodified version of that heightened sexual ritual in a strip club, which I'm not saying that there should be laws against them. I'm saying that, like, if I go to a strip club, I'm very aware that there's a possible corruption of my soul that might occur if I stick around too long. Do you know what I mean? And it almost seems like that's the version for the peasants. Like, while they're having their, like, Eyes Wide Shut parties at the Rothschild Mansion. Literally, they shot that at a Rothschild Mansion, by the way. You know, the peasants get, like, kind of a facsimile of that, a mass-produced copy, where there's no sex magic. There's only the commodification of the desire. Like, sex is a life-affirming act, right? Like, you are empowered by that, even if you're doing it for bad. Because you're Illuminati or whatever, like there's a magic to it, right?
Yeah, no, this isn't.
So I'm told. I'm saving myself.
This isn't like a situation where they're all doing these things to sort of hold each other to account. Like I've heard Alex Jones talk about some of the Bohemian Grove stuff, where they'll do things to each other to have dirt on each other to hold each other in a pact of sorts.
Yeah.
Act of silence. But with the masks in this one, where nobody knows who is who.
No, I think it's a ritual to empower them. Give them that, whatever that fucking dark side fucking energy, you know, like to get, or maybe just get off. I don't know.
So what do we learn from this movie? What is the arc that we're being shown by the end, what is the revelation that Bill has?
The revelation I got is that Kubrick should have somehow hid or made a copy of his director's cut before he showed it to the people that were obligated to print whatever he wanted and put it in theaters. Like, they were obligated contractually to give him final cut. And so there's really only one solution if this guy's like calling you out on your, in answer to your actual question, not just, you know, make a copy and mail it to yourself or mail it to somebody you trust. So you get the alchemist journey, right? Which is the path of enlightenment. So you can, with the knowledge that you have, you can learn to insulate yourself from the corruption, and you can seek to renew the strength in your relationship through honesty and connection like that. And sex is, you have to realize that it's a magical sort of act, and like, and realize the power in it, and you know, commit completely to that. That's like kind of almost the silver lining, though, to the darkness of the movie, which is the cycle of grooming us into gender roles that are horrific in nature. And I'm pretty sure what was cut was probably some mind control MKUltra stuff, or literally the child grooming of like Helena. Cause like, okay. So you get the three stages, right? With the whole mirroring, where you have like him as an innocent, and then him as seeing the world as it is. And you get like Helena means shining light, of course, innocent to begin with. And at the end, she's kind of given away. Did you like, she goes off in the background. You guys didn't do any of the, like, there's like so many like conspiracy videos about this movie. It's awesome. Like, stuff that I don't even agree with, but it just goes on and on. It's wonderful.
Well, I will say that my wife and I both noticed that when they have their final talk in the store, that Helena just fucks right off, and yeah, well, no big deal, you know, in this like massive department store. And we're like, as parents, we're like, no way would we just let the kids just run off.
Okay. So in that movie, in that, you get the magic circle. There's a bunch of magic circle boxes of toys. They're called magic circle right there. And there's like stars on the ground or whatever. And she goes off in the background, and she's met my two older guys that happen to be sitting at a table at Ziegler's party. Same actors. So that gets me pretty conspiracy hard. That's not a thing, but yeah. So basically my opinion is that ultimately Alice is leading him down the garden path to this corruption. And he's being initiated into it, into the darkness. And she's Helen is given away at the end to as a pact, right? With the
wait, so is
whatever
Alice,
this institution of power is.
Is Alice, by emasculating Bill, offering him the apple?
Yeah. And she's like laying in a garden later, and she's innocent in a dream, right? Like that's like the fall in the Bible, right? The Genesis.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, you feeling that?
A little bit, yeah. And again, this is something that you can look at this so many different ways and apply pre-existing things to it, and it sort of fits well enough to where, I don't know, I'd buy that for a dollar. So, yeah.
Well, it's like, which I love this. I like my viewing today because I thought about it in terms of the binary, right? Where you get the innocence going in, and then afterwards everything's changed, right? Like he wants to fuck Domino because he's looking for a sexual experience after being emasculated. And she's very sweet and everything's nice. And then he goes back and he finds out that she has AIDS from like another redhead. And it's interesting that she's like, you know, she's safe and wonderful. And he just like lays himself. He's like, can you just make me feel like a man, please? Right. And then at the end he comes back and it's like, she's got the worst thing ever. You can't have that. Right. Like, this is basically the they got my conspiracy hair standing up at the back of my head too, with the whole like AIDS, like, you know, if they got a cure, if it's even real or whatever. I'm sure it's real, by the way. I'm not suggesting it's not. I'm just saying I don't think that the people at that sex party are worried about AIDS. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's also some ambiguity about who is that masked woman at the sex party who saves him. Was it Domino? Was it Mandy? Was it somebody else? And we don't discover until near the end that it was Mandy there, most likely. Yeah.
I actually derailed you again. I'm really sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I'm sure I had this most amazing point to make, but now it's gone. But yeah, it seems to me that Bill's journey and even Alice's is to get out of the sort of just the motions of being in this relationship where they assume the best about each other and they finally admit to each other what, you know, sort of their true selves. Now, for Alice, it's mostly like in her head or what her base desires are. And for Bill, it's because she was pushing him away and emasculating him that he wanted to go and viscerally do something to, I don't know, like, if you're going to, you know, accuse me of this, then I'm going to go and do it. You know,
I think, honestly, I think it wasn't the accusation so much as the meanness, her cruelty.
Right. But by the end, they've now like awakened to the fact that their relationship is far more important than just going through the motions.
Yeah. So that's where the last line is, like, we should fuck now. Right. So if you take it as a positive where they're reconciling, then it's about getting back to the coalescence of their sort of sexual energies. Right.
And no longer taking each other for granted.
Yeah. And no longer viewing each other in an innocent way and accepting the reality of the other person as a human being with all sorts of terrible, sort of visceral needs and desires and a lizard brain inside there somewhere, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, that's how I read that whole emasculation. The demasculation was not necessarily her demasculating him, but rather her like admitting to these base desires that she really had no control over. And it was more like an admission of some kind of guilt.
She was picking a fight with him at the beginning, though. Like, she was being an asshole.
Well, she was smoking some good herb. I mean,
yeah. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, I've been in these fights before. These are, you don't win.
I thought
that
argument went pretty well scripted. Like, that felt,
that felt
like
real, eh? I was like, holy fuck, this is like way too real. I hate it when they do this.
This is like just like spot on.
It's like don't what are you, what stop are you talking about? Figure out what she wants. What she's saying is not what she wants. Yeah, that's the problem. That's the thing too, is like people say with they'll say things, but that's not what they want. By people, I mean her in that particular situation, and people like her that I've been in conversations with that were similar. But yeah, I mean, it extends to both the male and female. Like, we don't really say what we actually want. We are governed very much by, not we, maybe not the people in this room because we're so enlightened, but there's a lot of people that are governed by base instincts that are just leveraged by people that are way more controlled and smarter than them, you know? So, and then you see that sort of in when you have a fight with the spouse, it's just like that you guys are never, you're not even speaking the same language. Because men and women have completely different winning conditions, different emotional states, like different ways of seeing things. And so, like, you know, the language gets broken down pretty quick. So you end up like, are you just saying this? What you're saying is, you know, like the interview. But she literally does. She gives him that, like, so what you're saying is you just see me as a sexual object. And he's like, no, I didn't. I don't recall saying that. You said that, and now you're accusing me of it. I'm not sure how to get out of the situation. So, but yeah, like at one level, it's really just about that. It's just about a couple, interesting examining their egos and the deception of a relationship. Which Sandor says at the beginning, marriage is wonderful because it makes deception necessary to both parties.
So he was basically describing their initial relationship status prior to their awakening.
Yep.
So that was Sandor's sort of role in the narrative.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm sure there's, like you said, hundreds of hours of analytical content related to this movie on the YouTube. I did find a couple of things and I tried to watch a few of them, but there's only so much time in the day.
Well, and it's like, yeah, it's like watching that 237, right? Like, I enjoy watching analysis like that for its own sake. It doesn't have to even make sense. It doesn't, like, you know, I watched somebody analyze different sort of sacred geometry with, like, different places on Earth and drawing lines and stuff and talking about how, like, oh, this is connected and these guys did this. And then out of nowhere, he starts talking about how, like, the Ark of the Covenant has a mini black hole in it. Like, out of the blue, and I'm like, wow, this guy is... He's really in his own world, but I'm just going to keep listening because it's a really interesting story, you know?
It's not that David Wilcock guy, is it?
I don't know. Oh, no. Oh, fuck, I love that guy. It's one of my favorites. Because he's not like, he's just completely like, yep, I talked to an alien, motherfucker. What do you think of that?
Yeah, my wife and I, we were watching Ancient Aliens a couple of
weeks ago. That guy's awesome. Absolutely rad. Now, he'll describe in detail a conversation he had with, like, the Draconians. So... I mean, more power to him. I don't believe him, but I mean, I kind of do.
He spins a fine yarn.
Yeah, I mean, like, I believe Mad Max, Fury Road. I believe, you know, Tolkien. It's certainly more convincing than what I see in the news every day.
I'll grant you that.
Yeah, so just coming back, like I said, there's the four stages from Helen to the... prostituted girl at the costume store to whatever, to Domino, and then finally Alice, and then the cycle starts again with her giving her child up to the corrupt system, right?
Right, and even beyond that, you have the status of each of them, or the, you know, when Domino finds out that she's sick and dying, and then Mandy is dead, so like it's the whole cycle process through.
Yeah, and then simultaneously you get an alchemist journey of like the good side of that, or becoming enlightened, and like. Not choosing to just lay down and let these systems dictate what you do with your life and your relationship with your own essence, you could say, or God, right?
Okay. Well, we should probably wind this one down. So do you have any final notes that you want to bring up, Mike, or Robert, do you have any points that have piqued your interest or anything that you wanted to bring up?
I'll save my comments for my final summary, sir. Thank you. I feel woefully inadequate in this episode, but it's all good. I love Mike, and I love all the things he brings.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah, this is just the Mike C carrying the episode.
Well, I mean, you gave me a choice between this and I think, like, I don't know, G.I. Joe the movie or something. I was like, I think I'll go with Kubrick's swan song. Do you want mine next?
Yes.
Is that the plan? All right. Well, we didn't cover rainbows, which is... God's promise, it's the splitting of light into its components, so it's essentially like a representation of science as well. There's probably some 33rd degree angle shit that I haven't looked up, but I wouldn't be surprised if the whole masonry thing was connected to it. Where the rainbow ends, there's actually a shot in there where you use lens flare, like literally have a rainbow sort of curve into the pelvis area of the two players on screen, which I thought was interesting. But essentially this idea of the rainbow, aside from being like the promise of not flooding us again, is the reaching up to the heavens, like trying to be more than just an animal. That's where man is sort of, stuck, is trying to not be an animal and trying to, like, you know, we can't be gods. We get fucked over every time we try to do that, but we can elevate ourselves from these base instincts, which I find is interesting. And a rainbow is formed by like light and water sort of together sometimes. So I was thinking about the firmament and all that biblical stuff, but I wouldn't want to get into that too much. But rainbows are like a huge part of the movie, and it's like chasing the rainbow is like kind of the corruptive side of it, and just sort of dissecting the rainbow and sort of like using it as a guidance is kind of maybe the good side of it, if that makes sense. I think that he's pretty abstract with it, so... It probably sounds like I've just smoked a joint and I'm talking to another sophomore in college, but I just wanted to touch on the rainbows real quick. And like I said, the whole thing is about these sort of two divergent paths that a human can take to overcome.
I'll jump on that for just a little bit. So with the rainbow thing, especially when Bill's talking to the two young models at the party and they want to take him to the end of the rainbow, where there's the pot of gold, I think they make that joke. And
that means her vagina.
Right. Or it also means because at that time, Bill is striving to be more wealthy and successful, like those who are at the party.
Which would give him more
more pots of gold. but that's not really what's going to make Bill happy. What's going to make Bill happy is finding the enlightenment in that symbology of the rainbow. So it's not making it all the way to the end.
But yeah, that was kind of my take. Yeah, that's where I sat. But I'm like, I like the binaries. I like the non-binaries too. Don't come to my house and arrest me. But I like the binary nature of it and the possible sort of divergent paths of like good and evil. And I said this before, but the whole machine that needs our creative energy, so it separates us into individuals and commodifies our sexual experience, our intellectual experience, anything artistic is, you know, commodified and ground up, right? We don't really. Yeah. So yeah, I like this idea of like the alchemist path is understanding this world and being able to not be dominated by these base instincts and the people that would leverage those versus those that would chase greed and base instincts and form cabals of evil that, you know, and then they find their place in this sort of hierarchy and just fuck over anybody that's beneath them.
You know, okay.
Sort of two possibilities there.
And then he actually finds the gold by striving for the enlightenment by.
Yeah. The treasure was our friendship all along. The friends we made along the way.
All right. I think we're torturing this enough. So Robert, why don't we go to you for your final summary and review? And,
Sex of Fidelio. Okay. That's smart. I like that.
So why don't you give us how many passwords out of 10 for your rating that you'll give this?
Okay. So, Eyes Wide Shut. My review, I think it's going to sound real dumb. I'm obviously the odd man out on this episode. I heard all of what Dan and Mike were talking about, and I could see it from a certain perspective. You could see all this stuff in there, and more power to you. I'm certainly not afraid or... I do enjoy my own deep dives into things I find fascinating, of course. And if people find this particular piece of art fascinating, go on, dive right in and find all the meaning you can out of it. Absolutely. It's going to enrich your experience. Me as this first time Rube with his country hick eyeballs, I just saw a well done story about a guy that has kind of a weird night. It seems to me that this whole movie is Much Ado About Nothing. Nothing really happens. Not a whole lot. Pretty much everything done seems to be done consensually. Maybe not with the daughter. We don't understand how old she is. But even then, the father pimping her out, the costume store guy, is obviously creepy at best. I didn't see any of the Bill and Alice giving up their own daughter. Maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention, but I didn't see any of that. And I didn't even see them necessarily being groomed. I saw two characters at the end not going and exploring that any further, not seeing that world, you know, more strengthening their own relationship instead of them getting into some kind of kinky lifestyle or anything like that. I know I'm examining this from a very base, dumb level, and I'm okay with that. This is fine. I'll leave it to the other expert guys to examine it on a more esoteric level. I did enjoy this film quite a bit. It's fairly well done in terms of just the storytelling, like the mystery of what's happening, and you can leave it up to, it's very ambiguous. So, you know, you're going to see different things based on your own life experience and whether you think a character is telling the truth or not. There's no real, a whole lot of physical evidence presented that's going to prove one character to be a liar or not. So you're left up to your own understanding and your own reading and analysis of what's happening in the film. So that's a lot of fun. I could see why this movie is analyzed from infinite angles and explored on the internet for decades and decades, and I'm sure will be continued to do so. What was the rating system? I forget what it was.
Out of 10, arbitrary thing.
I was going with passwords because he asked for a second password when there actually was not a second password. So why not there be potentially 10 passwords?
Okay, how many passwords out of 10? So I would say that this film garners 7 passwords out of 10 from Robert. I don't think it's necessarily Kubrick's best work, but it is a fairly accessible piece. If you're just watching it on a Robert level, if you're watching it on any higher levels, it's, I don't know, but it probably has that ability to be enjoyed by many different people. So take that for what I have to say. Anyway, all right. Not the best Christmas movie of all time, but one of the better Christmas movies of all time.
Okay. So it's behind Die Hard and It's a Wonderful Life.
It's behind Wonderful Life, behind Die Hard. It's ahead of A Home Alone, and it's ahead of Gremlins.
What about Elf?
Yeah, it's ahead of Elf. Because Elf is so shabby. It's got a few good jokes.
What about Kingdom of Heaven?
Does that take place during Christmas time?
No. Well, I mean, I think the Crusades was just a long 100-year period of Christmas.
Okay. Gotcha.
All right, so 7 passwords on the Rube Robert scale. All right.
Yes, right.
Perfect. All right, so I guess I'll go, and then Mike will let you do the, the best for last kind of thing. My kids always say best for last. So I am a big Kubrick fan, and there's always so much meaning packed into everything that he does, every scene, every framing of the camera, with the sets and the colors and things in the foreground, things in the background, similarities, reflections, refractions, and all the rest, that this is the type of movie that I think you need to watch several times to try to tease out like different ideas and different explorations that you can kind of wander through. This is only the second time that I've seen this, and I still get the, on its face, it's kind of a story about nothing really happening, a bunch of almost things happening, but at the last minute, that thing doesn't actually happen. And so when you watch it at that level, like, it lacks the sort of emotional impact, especially at the end when Tom Cruise's character is crying to Alice, to Nicole Kidman's character. It's like, well, but he didn't do anything. He did all these almost things, and he's like admitting this to her and breaking down over it. But when you look at it, on a little bit of a deeper level, and I tried to keep up with our guest, Mike, a little bit here, then I can see that there is more like going on psychologically within these characters and in this study of their interaction that goes beyond just what we're presented with this story that's almost a story about nothing. So with that, I'm going to give it a pretty good score. I'm going to go with 6.5 passwords out of 10. I don't think this is Kubrick's best work, but it is... it is one worthy of watching, like I said, several times, and have some ideas of what you're looking for in it. And I'm sure you'll find it, because that's kind of what he does. He makes it ambiguous enough to where you can kind of tease out and divine whatever theory you sort of have in mind and find those place markers to kind of make you think that you're on the right path. So that's my take, and we'll go over to you, Mike.
Okay. Yeah. If you don't think this is a 10 out of 10 film, then hashtag restore the Kubrick cut, I suppose. He presented it to the people that thought he was making a sexy movie with a power couple, and then a few days later he died mysteriously, which I find interesting. And some people say some stuff's missing, which might have maybe even ham-fisted. It might have pushed this out of the sort of superficial to the sort of deep esoteric meaning. But I don't know. That's exactly what I like about it, is that there's so many layers. You can watch it a few times. It doesn't preach to you. It just tells you, some ways of looking at the world, and the sort of the different sort of competing ideas in it are kind of wonderful. Out of 10, I'd say 19 for 19 iterations of a virus. And also that was her morgue chiller. Door was 19 above her, the Mandy character that was sacrificed. And it's also a very unlucky number for the Babylonians, which is that whole Revelation 666, one world government sort of narrative. So it's all a bunch of weird coincidence. So I say 19 out of 10. 9/11, Bush, Harambe.
All right. So Mike's throwing a little symbolism at us here at the end here. So I appreciate that, Mike. Well, this was a fun conversation, and I hope you can stick around for a little bit longer for the Kathleen Turnover Drive, which is the special time that we give to the Patreon supporters. So go to lastknives.com/Patreon for that, everyone. And Robert, we're going to be doing something that I threatened you with a couple of months back, and it's ridiculous. It's dad joke level, but we're coming up on the month of May. And so it's that time. It's time for the Matrix. We're going to be doing the four different iterations of the Matrix. So each week, until our conditions are met, we're doing the Matrix next week with Jeremiah Martin of Reel on Reels podcast, another movie podcast. And then after that, we're going to be doing Reloaded. And then the week after that, Revolutions. And the final week will be the Animatrix, which is a bunch of short stories. And each guest that we'll have on will get their take on the original Matrix, of course, as well. And we'll try to tease out some things we can talk about with the new one, the reboot, that is forthcoming at some point in the near future.
Well, that's a whole lot of content. Hopefully you'll be able to stick with us. Hopefully we'll have different things to say each time. It's a complex film with a lot of deep meaning. I'm surprised Mike isn't one of our guests scheduled for that, but it should be fun.
Yeah, it should be fun. And we're also going to be doing a couple of specials. There's going to be a Cinco de Mayo special in there with Desperado, with the guy from Peddling Fiction, and also a Memorial Day episode with a combat veteran. And that one will be Jarhead. So wow, we got a bunch of content coming up. And we've even threatened our friend Pat McFarlane of Liberty Weekly to do a May the 4th episode talking about Star Wars and where we are in the trilogy in real life. Like, are we at Empire? Are things looking up? Are things looking bad? So we're going to be pretty busy in the next little while here.
It's a lot of content coming at you. Hopefully you all enjoy it.
The Matrix is Exodus.
All right, we'll get into it a little bit more, Mike.
read Exodus, please, before you watch the movie.
I will not do that,
Mike. All right, well, at least look up Nebuchadnezzar and Zion, then. All anyway, right, you're good.
Robert can do that. All right. Well, anyway, everyone, that's what we're going to be doing next week. Check out the show notes and more for this one at lastknives.com/173, and I'll have links to Mike's musical escapades that he does at Mechanical Dream Revolution. It's really good stuff. I am his top fan, or whatever the nomenclature is on the SoundCloud. But if I were a stockholder, I would have the majority voting rights. I think that's pretty much how it goes, right, Mike?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much. And we'll be seeing you next week with The Matrix for Matrix. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and just a couple more minutes on the Actual Anarchy podcast, just because, you know, we still make this sandwich here. Robert, I was wondering if you had any different expectations going into it. I know when they promoted this film, it was supposed to be promoted as this hot Hollywood couple doing steamy sex stuff. And so it caught a lot of people off guard when they went to go and watch this movie in theaters when it came out 21 years ago. Did you have a similar... I think you kind of mentioned this, but this did not go with your expectations, even though you knew it was a Kubrick film and you knew that, you know, he'd always be doing weird stuff, right?
Yeah. So my expectations for the film were to have some kind of, like, he was going to reveal a secret world of the power elite having their kinky sex world power games. And I mean, I guess on one level you could kind of read it that way, but it more seemed like, yeah, people like to do kinky stuff, and this is about the tamest kinky stuff you could ever imagine. A casual, and I mean a casual, browsing of any porn website, and you're going to see stuff way more out there than this. I mean, obviously you don't get this guy's a Rothschild and this guy's whatever that you're going to get here. But I don't even know if that really changes a whole lot for me.
So what if you happen to be having sex with some Rothschild girl? Does that do it for you? Or is that somehow immoral? Are you saying that? I mean, I remember the whole time this left was really getting upset when there's like a power dynamic difference between two people having sex, that there's always like an oppressor and someone's always an oppressed or a victim and one's an attacker. And like, if there's a Louis C.K. was jerking off in front of people, that he couldn't do that because he inherently had some more power than this other female comedian he was doing it in front of. We're all adults here. And just because somebody has the power to offer you wealth and power in exchange for doing a thing doesn't mean you have to do it. You're being offered something. You can say no, and you're not a victim.
Wait, are you saying that the people should starve then, Robert? Because
they're not willing to talk during this part.
Okay, this is a question to me, Mike. You just need to just hang on just a second.
It's just Marxism, right?
Marxism.
That's just what they're doing. It's just Marxist horseshit, isn't it? This whole power dynamic,
the power
shit.
Crap.
Yeah, it's just. Yeah. I mean, it's just garbage. It's Cain and Abel. Like, it's just fucking Marxism rebranded yet again because it just won't die. It's like an infestation. Got to nuke the fucker from orbit. It's the only way.
Right, but that's why I'm saying that this movie was a whole lot of nothing. Like, one person will look at it and say, "Ooh, these evil Rothschilds, they're having sex with prostitutes." Or these lower class people, or people with less money and influence, and that there's somehow some evil power dynamic going on, when in reality it's a bunch of people getting off.
Okay, so this is basically the limitations of sort of libertarianism, and at the same time, in a lot of ways, like the Christian philosophies, because they're susceptible to, you know, like how in Rules for Radicals you hold. Rules for Radical
your
states
enemies to their principles.
Yes, right? So that's exactly the problem, right? You end up with this situation where like, oh, well, Google's a private company. It's like, yeah, that's fine, right? Like, yeah, pornography should be legal. Strippers and prostitution should be legal. But like, it is probably a good idea to examine how that affects your psychology, aka your soul. You know what I mean? Like, is this a corrupting act? Is becoming addicted to... like drugs, alcohol, sexualized or like pornographic sexuality or pornographic imagery in every single facet of our industry, like cars, everything is all just, it's all pornographic and it's all like a vicious attack on your brain. And, you know, you could call that the soul if you want. Is that good for you? I'm not arguing whether it should be right or wrong. I'm just saying, like, is it good to sleep with like 100 people? I mean, it's fun. Maybe. I wouldn't know. I'm saving myself for marriage, but
well, it's fun. I'm just saying, like, it's not. And you're right. You're right. Libertarianism doesn't necessarily have an answer for that. It's a very limited philosophy.
Well, no, it's not spiritual. It's not examining the implications spiritually. And I'm just using that as kind of a placeholder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's perfectly fine.
And so I think that's the question, is that it's kind of a different feel. Like, I like the minutiae of like rights and things like that, but often like the reason I focus on propaganda is because we're spiritually weakened. There's no masculinity, and that's ultimately what's going to insulate us from these sort of corruptions and protect rights in general, right? Because like nobody's firing any bullets yet. Nobody's like, there's not enough businesses open that I can go and support these businesses, you know? That are opening against lockdowns and things like that. There's nothing I can really do at that level because like, we've just been sort of weakened over time by indulgence and corruption. And so I think it's really good to examine, you know, our spiritual needs as well as our, you know, just basic finance and shit, right? Because like, yeah, I mean, it's good to buy Bitcoin when it's cheap and it's good to invest and diversify and understand markets and stuff. But ultimately, like, they control every aspect from the very top to the very bottom because they beat us to the high ground. And when you have the high ground, there's just nothing you can do about it. That's a Star Wars reference.
I know.
You make some fair
points there, Mike. You make some
fair
points.
It's just very important. It's just very important for the ideals and the principles that you want to succeed. to be examining, you know, is this good or bad, right? It's like, because we gotta do a lot of the heavy lifting for people that are just wandering around jerking off like 10 times a day or whatever, filling their bodies with Coca-Cola, you know, and they're block voting against us, right? So, I mean, I don't believe in democracy, but everyone else seems to, and they all decided together that my opinion doesn't matter because there's 9 against 1. You know, like how a gang rape is ethical because if everybody votes, it's like 90% affirmation, right?
Sure.
Is that a terrible analogy?
No, it's great. I make that one often. Well, at least I used to. I don't get into Facebook fights anymore because I need to try to maintain my being able to be on Facebook.
People like two wolves and a sheep deciding on dinner. People find it a little more palatable. But I'm like, I'm not really interested in your comfort when you're arguing about what I'm allowed to do and not do. It's like we're losing a spiritual war. We're not like, it's like libertarianism is actually on their side because, like, a bunch of security guards showed up at a bunch of grocery stores in my, you know, in my area, and they're demanding that I wear a mask to go grocery shopping now. And they're like, we're a private entity. And I'm like, oh, you're all fucking libertarians now? Like, 5 years ago, we were talking about baking the cake, forcing Christians to bake like dick cakes or whatever the fuck they wanted. You know, it's like, okay, now we're all in favor of these rights, right? And I'm like, well, neither one of these extremes is actually correct. Like, even if we want to get to an anarchy place, we all, like, that business signed on, it got a business license, it operates within the purview of a government. So, and I can argue the laws that it's breaking based on that. So either they reject the authority that they are subjugated themselves to, or they don't, you know, like, I don't get it. But like, yeah, suddenly all the businesses are all in favor of property rights. And that's only when it's Google and Amazon and everybody towing the line. It's never in favor of the small businesses or the individual sovereignty. So
yeah,
they hold us to our own standards, and we can't do anything about it.
Right. When it's the restaurant staying open in spite of the lockdown, it's never, well, they're a private company, they can do what they want. It's never the gym that stays open and thumbs their nose at government. Well, they're a private company, they can do what they want.
Oh, no, they're killing your grandmother.
Sure.
Yeah, it's asymmetrical for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, Coca-Cola is fun to drink for about 3 sips. And then after that, I want to throw it away. And that's what I do. I just drink half a can, just chuck it out because.
They still have those
actually,
little short.
That actually
short
helps
cans.
The market, huh?
They have this little short can still, like 3 ounce.
That's what I need, man. I just want like one delicious. You know, like that first sip is just like ecstasy. It's like crack, yeah. Right?
Coca-Cola.
And then after that, you're like, this is fucking poison. Don't do this anymore. yeah, pornography. You know, like, I'm just saying, it's weakened us. Our, you know, I read a I have a copy of the Boy Scouts handbook from like the 50s, and it doesn't say like masturbation is forbidden. It just says you don't want to tire yourself out or wear yourself out because you may need you to be at your best at any given time. And I thought that was really good advice for a young boy who is. I didn't get that book when I was in the 50s because I wasn't around then. But I do remember discovering masturbation and it being a focus for my life for a little while. So, and it's true. If you can find discipline and whatever spiritual guidance you need to get that, you know, that insulates you from these terrible, terrible people trying to take all your shit.
Mm. Yeah. So you became a bit of an enthusiast for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I mean, certainly addicted, but. I'm totally not addicted anymore.
All right. Well, I think we should wind this one down. This has been a little bit of extra bonus content for everyone on the actual Anarchy Podcast.
Oh, shit, yeah.
We're going to get into the actual Captain Turner Overdrive, where we do talk even looser than this right after this. So go to actualanarchy.com/230 for the show notes and more for this one, and join us next week for our take on The Matrix with Jeremiah Martin of Real on Reels. And we will see you guys all then. And until then, maximum freedom. Peace.
the chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.